Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has Rick Perry made Texas a better place? He stepped up from his post as lieutenant governor when George W. Bush was elected president in 2000 and went on to handily defeat every gubernatorial challenger he faced in the years that followed. My guests today have closely followed Texas issues and politics in the Perry era and have concluded the efforts of this longest-serving governor have yielded some very admirable results, but also some major disappointments. Erica Greeter and Brian D. Sweeney write for Texas Monthly. They both contributed to a report card of Governor Perry's years in office that appears in the July issue of the magazine. It also features a wide-ranging exit interview of Governor Perry by Brian Sweeney. Erica and Brian, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having us,
Thank
Chris.
You. Always happy to be here.
So Rick Perry has been governor of Texas for such a long time, long enough to have witnessed the results of many of his initiatives. What is he proudest of?
One of the things that he had told me in the interview that I did with him at the Capitol was that I asked him, what do you think is the high point of your administration or the legislation that you're the proudest of? And he referred to the tort reform that began in the 2003 session. That was the main push for it. We saw a little bit more in 2005. But in that sense, he believed that tort reform was one of the key agents that allowed the Texas economy to begin to go forward, that it got rid of frivolous lawsuits, that it protected small businesses, it allowed for doctors to come in to the state. And that was something that I thought was an interesting conversation to have with him, in part because that really became a partisan issue. A lot of people who disagreed with that thought that that was something that was, a nod to the far right and to sort of the big business constituencies, and was an interesting conversation, I thought, to have with him about that particular legislation.
How much?
It's interesting.
Go ahead.
I was going to add to that. I mean, he talks about tort reform a lot, and it is sort of a murky issue as far as the results. But when he gives his sort of 4-point recipe for how the state's done so well, that's the piece of it that he really owns the most. He talks about low taxes, low spending, fair and effective regulation. But all those aspects of state policy have been approaches that really predated Governor Perry or any modern governor. And tort reform is kind of his signature, I think, for that reason, too.
So he does get an A grade for economic development. How do employment and poverty rates in Texas now compare with other states?
Well, on every employment metric, they are substantially better for the most part than you see in other major states and in the country as a whole. I mean, we've seen job growth since he's been governor for every industry, every sector, every region of the state, and every income quartile, which I think is an important aspect of this. It's not just minimum wage jobs being created. It's not just rich people getting richer. There's really been pretty broad-based job growth. We've seen employment numbers overall grow by about 2 million. The state population has grown by about 4 million. So the employment rate has roughly kept pace. On the income metrics, we historically as a state have been sort of a lagger as far as household income, median incomes, hourly incomes. And today we're still a little bit behind the national average. Maybe it's about 49,000 median household income in Texas compared to 50,000 nationally, but it's still a pretty low cost of living state. So I think on that sense, we're doing quite well. The issues that we're not doing as well in terms of the economy are things like the poverty rate, which hasn't really gotten worse, but it remains pretty high in Texas. It's always been high and it still is high. And things like wealth metrics, so household savings, access to credit. We have a very high rate of people who are unbanked or underbanked. I think those things would rightly merit more attention from either party after Perry's gone.
He doesn't have an official grade in this issue with regard to border concerns. But since the governor is calling now for President Obama to visit the border in Texas while he's here this week, let's talk a little bit about Perry's record on border issues. How open has he been to immigration and how has he dealt with the presence of undocumented immigrants in the state?
Well, it's funny because if you think back to that sort of brief but colorful presidential campaign of 2011, his relative moderation on immigration issues, on illegal immigration, was one of the things he was getting a lot of flack for from within the party. So, for example, he signed the measure that allowed in-state tuition rates for certain unauthorized students who had graduated from Texas high schools, the so-called Texas Dream Act. It didn't provide any path to legalization. That's not in the governor's power to do so, but it was sort of a thoughtful, pragmatic, centrist policy that passed the legislature with bipartisan, almost unanimous support, and the governor signed it. And 10 years later, it came back to haunt him as this sort of gesture of incredible rhino behavior.
We were the first state in the country to pass that. Yeah. In fact, beat California to do so in very early in Governor Perry's tenure.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I think it really has always, for about 10 years, it was just like, what a good idea. What a kind of thoughtful policy. If kids finish high school and do well, like, why should we discourage them from going to college if they're qualified to do so and aspire to do so? And so it wasn't really contentious. And it's become contentious, too, even before this border crisis of the summer. It was becoming contentious among Republicans who are now running to replace Rick Perry, right? So you see someone like Dan Patrick, now the party nominee for lieutenant governor, saying, I would never have done that. I'm going to repeal that. And a substantial share of the party going along and taking that view of it.
It does seem like a shift in a way, in that it seems that Republican governors in particular of border states until recent years had often had a slightly different take on immigration than their counterparts in states that aren't along the border. That seems
Absolutely.
To be changing.
The notion of if you show me a 50-foot wall, I will show you a 51-foot ladder. I mean, I think that that's something that has always been talked about, that states like Texas and Arizona, for example, that share longer borders with Mexico have a better sense of what the problem is and how the problem is solved. I think it's different in the Texas experience in the sense that we have always had this. There has always been migration back and forth across the border. And I think where we have seen the discourse ratchet up and become a little bit sharper and a little bit more elbows thrown, quite frankly, has been when we get into election season and candidates are looking to make news for themselves. I think Patrick being a good example of this. In that sense, we've always seen that Governor Perry has been more moderate on that. And again, as Erica had said, you know, took some lumps from it when he was running for president. On the other hand, I think that what we're seeing right now also cannot be completely ignored in the vein of what his aspirations might be for 2016. Right. One of the things that has always been very successful for any candidate in Texas is to run against the national government, is to run against federal overreach. And here is a case where, regardless of what is actually happening and why on the border, it's a pretty good punch to throw that the federal government is not doing enough, and then to take the additional step of encouraging, you know, the president to come and take a look. The one thing that we have known over the years, Chris, of course, is that the number one driver in terms of how we see migration patterns happen over the Rio Grande is what is happening with our economy. Right. When our economy is strong, the borders are very active. And when the economy is weak, as we saw in 2008 and the years following that, we come down to a near net zero migration.
Mm-hmm. It's actually really, you know, it's a tricky issue this time around, because at some points, we're getting a bit off track from Perry here, so I'll keep this short. But as Brian says, you know, there's about 11.7, I think, million unauthorized immigrants in the United States, and Mexico is the single biggest migrant-sending country for the United States because of our long border and for the economic reasons Brian mentioned. And we have seen Mexican unauthorized immigration track pretty closely to what's happening in the national and state economy. And the summer's crisis is sort of different. It's smaller overall. It's a small share overall of unauthorized migration. But it's a big uptick in people from a certain set of countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, many of whom are children, and women and children, family groups. And they're not migrating for the same reasons. They're almost more appropriately conceived of as refugees than illegal immigrants, as we have come to know them over the past 10, 15 years. So, and, you know, it's a different kind of situation to manage in the Rio Grande Valley sector, which is historically sleepy. So we're watching this sort of political debate shift, I think, in response to this year's election politics in Texas and the prospect of 2016 campaigns. At a moment when the immigration policy debate probably should be changing, too, if we were setting aside all the politics of the issue. So we'll be watching that one. So will you, I'm sure.
Yeah, and indeed. So we mentioned the in-state tuition for immigrant students without documentation. Texas Monthly gives Governor Perry a B- overall for higher education and a D for public education. Before we talk about the disparities between those grades, what has been the effect of tuition deregulation on the affordability of public colleges and universities in Texas?
This has become the key issue, and we wrote a little bit about that, you know, John Connolly is really remembered as the governor who put large investments immigrants into higher education in the state of Texas. And this is good for both people on the left and the right. It was good for people on the left because it expanded opportunity and got more people into colleges. It was good for the right and for the business community because to have a highly educated workforce essentially led, planted the seeds for the boom that we've been enjoying, high tech and defense industry and things like that. In my mind, tuition deregulation is the big signature legislation that Governor Perry has passed. And what we have seen is that it has had an effect on pocketbooks for individual families. What it ended up doing was lowering the state share of what it was providing for higher ed, essentially subsidizing schools like the University of Texas and Texas A&M. And it has made it much more difficult, I think, for average families to put their kids through school. And it has certainly made it harder, I think, for those students who are at the lower end of the economic scale to gain access to higher education. It has been a real problem. And even though money has been made available and set aside for grant programs, there is not enough money in the grant program to cover that need. And so in the interview that I did with him, I asked him specifically about higher ed, because as you know, we also have other issues around governance and accountability that are swirling around. But the pocketbook issue, of course, is the one that speaks to most Texans. And one of the interesting things that he had said to me was that if he had it to do over on that particular bill, what he would do is go back and make sure that there were clearer triggers in place that would provide opportunities for university systems, UT system, Texas A&M system, to increase tuition only if they had met certain accountability benchmarks. And I thought that was an interesting and thoughtful exchange. But where we are right now is that in large part because the state share, as we have seen in so many of these other areas, because the state share of funding has gone down, the burden has been passed along to the individual families. And what that means is we're not all helping to subsidize, whether you have a child getting ready to go to college or not. We're not all sharing in that. It is hitting now disproportionately those people who are trying to get their kids a college degree.
Is that likely to hurt the state economically? Or as I understand it, a lot of different states, whether it's by tuition deregulation or other means, a lot of states are now placing a greater burden for public university education on the individual student.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's no question that that's the trend, as we have seen state governments pull back, what has been the trend. I think the thing that is tricky for Texas is that because we have such a population boom, and when we toggle over to what we're doing with public ed, and we're adding roughly 80,000 school-age kids a year to our public school systems, that incidentally is about the size of adding a Fort Worth ISD every single year. The question is, are we providing the infrastructure and the resources necessary to get folks ready for college? And so even though we are doing well right now, because of the population boom, if we're not making accommodations and not making it easier for people to get to college, we will begin to lose, I think, our competitive edge in the workforce. And a lot of these other issues, as we write about in higher ed related to governance, have in fact come out of this very issue. That dereg hit fairly early in Governor Perry's administration, but now we are really having talk about the $10,000 degree and, you know, issues related to governance and accountability that right now are still riling UT as we speak, as we see that conflict between the Board of Regents and what is happening, say, at the flagship university, UT Austin. I think all of those things are related. And so B minus, I think, is a fair grade for Governor Perry in terms of trying to address these issues. On the other hand, I think that there were unintended consequences for what have happened that we are still dealing with and quite frankly have not figured out as we, you know, begin to move farther and farther down the path of potentially impeaching one of the regents who has been involved in the accountability question.
We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly journalists Brian D. Sweeney and Erica Greeter. The cover story for the July issue is called Rick Perry Exits the Stage. The issue also features a one-on-one interview with the governor. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. If you want to send me a tweet, you can do that at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalists Erica Greeter and Brian D. Sweeney of Texas Monthly, which has a report card on Governor Rick Perry in its July issue as the cover story. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So you mentioned that on average, we add about 80,000 children to the rolls of Texas public schools every year. For the 2012-2013 school year, the state chose not to fund enrollment growth in school districts. What was the effect of that in real terms on K-12 campuses?
Well, that's a good point. That enrollment growth was put back in the last legislative session, but remember how difficult the 2011 legislative session was, where we ended up cutting more than $5 billion from public ed programs. We had cut in the previous session in 2009 about $3 billion, and so we were about $8 billion in the whole total coming into that. And what we ended up doing, despite the fact that there had been this very strong argument or debate raging about how much money is enough per pupil for us to spend to get an adequate education, we ended up seeing things like summer programs being ended, teachers were losing their jobs, programs were being cut back. I will tell you, I'm a very, very proud parent of a daughter who was in the Texas public schools, and one of the things that she lost in her elementary school was her Spanish language program. So there was a sense that when people were saying that this was not hitting the schools, we had evidence to the contrary. In that sense, I think that one of the things that you will see in our report card where we were looking at these different areas, and I'd like to say very quickly that the areas that we identified we thought were important to look at for any governor of any era of any party in the state of Texas, the things that we thought were absolutely integral to what was to the smooth functioning of our state and the economic and social growth of our state. And when we focused on public ed, I think one of the things that we were looking at is that there was a lack of political imagination, I think, to solve some of these problems related to the school systems, because we are educating now such an unbelievably diverse population. It is much harder now to educate our school children than it was 30 or 40 years ago, just because the dynamics of the student population and the access to the schools has changed so much. So I think that was one of the things that we were very concerned about, that it's absolutely appropriate to have a conversation about what is fiscally prudent. But one of the things that we worried about, and I will say quite frankly that I worried about, was almost the degree to which the legislature relished the opportunity to cut funding in the 2011 session. There was also difficult to look at that because I think that in the rush to balance the budget, remember that at that point, Governor Perry was going to be looking to become President Perry and running in that next election cycle. I think it was hard to take a look at some of those decisions related to cutting of funding as not something that was designed to burnish credentials as a very fiscally conservative Republican candidate. And I think, quite frankly, it did damage to public policy.
What is he weighing, if he's weighing anything, in deciding if he really is going to run in 2016? Is it a foregone conclusion, or is he really deciding what he wants to do?
I think he really is deciding at this point, or I suspect he is. I think he's probably allocating more time to the decision this time around. I think last time around, he probably spent about a month or two thinking about the prospect and then before jumping in, which is partly why you saw a somewhat disorganized campaign effort on his part. Certainly this time around, having had that experience, he knows he has to do it really well if he does it at all. So I think he's probably, like most of the prospects for 2016, looking at how this year's midterm elections shape out in Congress, looking at who else is sort of, you know, eyeing the territory.
Absolutely.
And possibly getting the race, including perhaps another Texan, our junior Senator Ted Cruz. So he's probably just waiting for some more aspects of groundwork to
I think that's right. And I think that you see that Cruz has certainly excited the base here in Texas in a way that perhaps Governor Perry is not. We saw it in the straw poll for the convention, though the speech that the governor gave at the convention was very much a national-looking speech and looking forward. Mm-hmm. I certainly asked him about this, and it was how we ended our interview, was to what is going to be next for him after having served when he leaves office in January of 2015. He will have served for 14 years. That's longer than Franklin Roosevelt was president. It's an astounding amount of time. Mm-hmm. And what he told me was that, first of all, he will go back to being private citizen Rick Perry, though at that point he didn't know what that was going to be. Interesting, some of the news stories that had come out later that he was considering, you know, California, if only he could afford to live there. I don't have any doubt that it is on his radar screen. And one of the things that he had said that this would allow him to do, as Erica acknowledged, was to have more preparation than what he had had the previous time. I look, though, at the damage that it did to Perry's brand nationally, because it was such a disastrous effort the first time around. And I think it's difficult for him to recover for that.
You know, it's interesting, though. I was thinking, too, that the first thing that happens after Perry leaves office in 2015 is that the legislature reconvenes, right? And so we have this new cast of characters, not just a new governor, but a new lieutenant governor, probably the same Speaker of the House. I think Joe Strauss will be reelected as Speaker of the House easily. But a whole new set of leaders, which is a change from about 10 years. We've had a pretty consistent set of guys in there. And there's this real sort of Tea Party tenor among a lot of the incoming legislators, among the most likely next lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, and Greg Abbott, the attorney general, who's leading the polls right now for the gubernatorial election, is pretty conservative himself. So there's a chance that once Perry's off the stage for 4 or 5 months, people are going to start looking back like, actually, Perry was a pretty mellow guy when you think about it, compared to the ledge that just legalized open carry and closed the border and so on.
Right. As you suggest, Dan Patrick saying that he would be interested in rolling back in-state tuition for undocumented students who have finished. I mean, that is, would be a profound change, I think.
I think so, too.
He doesn't talk a lot about his apparent reforms in criminal justice. Maybe he can't talk it up as a Republican in this current climate. But he has been something of a reformer on drug sentences and criminal justice overall.
That's, I think, an area where he's probably been most reform-oriented in a way that would surprise people who haven't been following it. Because, of course, like most Texas governors would, and as Rick Perry in particular does, he has this sort of tough-talking, tough-on-crime sort of aspect to him, and he just comes across as somebody who, of course, would have tough-on-crime views and a pretty sheriff-type aspect about the whole thing. And then he has certain elements of his record, the fact that he's presided over more executions than any governor in Texas history, for example, and been a robust defender of capital punishment. That would further that impression. But then if you kind of look behind that, there's been a lot of things that have been less high profile as far as reforms, but he signed a number of things that have changed penalties for minor drug possession, for example. He introduced more drug courts rather than incarceration. He signed, even on the death penalty, the state's law that allows life without parole, which has caused the number of death sentences being handed down in Texas to really collapse. So I think, as you say, he probably couldn't be that public about it. It's sort of perhaps a only Nixon goes to China kind of thing, that only a Republican tough guy governor of a tough state can start this sort of trend.
That's a good point. And when I spoke with him about this, he talked at length about the drug courts, which he pointed out was brought to him by a Democratic judge, that he said that, you know, my party does not have a lock on all of the good ideas. I think that's very interesting. And again, I think one of the profound things that we have seen with the death penalty is the fact that in 2005, Texas changed a law that people were very critical of, which at that point only allowed juries in capital cases to choose between the death penalty and life with parole. Mm-hmm. And I think in the environment that Texas has always brought to criminal justice, juries were very, very reluctant to make that second choice and say that if I vote for this, there is a chance that that person could be back out on the streets. And in doing that, we have seen the number of inmates being sent to death row drop dramatically. In 2002, it was 37 people. And in 2013, it was down to 9. That is a profound change in the way that we're handling this aspect.
Absolutely. And overall, it's sometimes kind of funny because Texas historically has had, you know, some pretty bad rankings on a number of issues, right? So sometimes when we're looking at rankings for the state in a number of policy areas, we're looking at a better ranking that's not really that great altogether. So the state's overall incarceration rate, we used to have the second highest incarceration rate in the country. Now we're down to fourth. So good for us.
One of very few things that the governor's champions and his critics can mostly agree on was that the executive order with regard to the human papillomavirus vaccine for girls was kind of a disaster. What does the governor say about this now, and would he change the way he carried this out?
Absolutely. That was when I asked him about things that he would have done differently or you know, one of the low points, I guess you'd say, of the administration. That was the idea that he jumped on, was that he had tried to, through executive order, get this passed, and he had strong pushback on both sides. He lost with the people who would have typically been his political opponents and those people that he thought who would have been with him. It did not help that a former chief of staff of his, Mike Toomey, had been a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical company that stood, you know, by all measures to have gained from this going through. And I think that he told me that that was a case where he misread the field, right? I had asked him, you know, quickly about that, that why not just support the bill, you know, have somebody carry the bill and then you give your support and your endorsement to it. And again, I just think that there is a case where for whatever reason, he fumbled the ball on that one. I still don't think, though, I mean, and he would say that those people who say that this was, you know, crony capitalism or that he was doing this for his friends, he pushed back very, very strongly on that and said that that absolutely was not the case. But of course, that was exactly how it played in the media, and that in many ways, this became the gold standard, I guess, of those types of things. But I do think it is one of the things that he regrets. But again, you know, one of the things that he would say is that his heart was in the right place. He has a desk beside his big desk in the Capitol building where he has his private office. He has pictures of veterans who have died and young women who had died from cervical cancer. And so as he's explaining this to me in his office, it was very powerful. He wheeled around in his chair and he showed me this picture of a young woman from Houston who was a teacher who had died and showed me her face and said, you know, this is why I was doing this. And this is who I was thinking about when I was trying to get this done. I wasn't thinking about all of the criticism that came, and that was not what I was expecting. And I have to say, it was a very powerful case, but obviously that's one that that I think was a mistake on his part and was, you know, taken back.
It's interesting because I think it was a mistake on his part. He said that, I mean, people have said that repeatedly, and it's arguably, I think, his biggest single sort of misstep in these 14 years as governor, which is pretty shocking if you think about it, that that's the one thing he's done of all the things he's done that excited the most public backlash. And I'm sure we'll hear about it going forward if he ends up reappearing on the national stage, because it's, as Brian says, there's a pretty good case that he wasn't trying to do anything bad. It just happened to be badly managed, poorly rolled out, and he would have done it differently. So that's, you know, the kind of mistake you can easily imagine him talking about during a presidential debate. What did you learn from your experience? I learned I should be more careful about trying to stop cancer. You know, it's...
The governor's more cynical critics have pointed to his eyeglasses. This might seem like a minor issue, but they're saying that this is like almost a costume piece. And I wonder if either one of you has spoken to him about why he's now wearing spectacles when I suppose before he wore contact lenses or whatever.
The story that we were told, again, he is photographed on the cover, is sort of interesting that people have been talking about his fashion choices. You know, we just saw the big story in the New York Times about him not wearing boots. And so you can see on our cover, he is not wearing boots and he is wearing the glasses, which there was never any question during our shoot that he was going to wear the glasses. The story that that I am told is that he was struck in the eye by a rock when he was a young boy and that there has always been some scarring on his retina and that this has become more problematic for him as he has gotten older and that the glasses have solved the problem better than the contact lenses. I also think that there is a case to be made that if you were going to be taking your candidate back out onto the national stage after round one, this is one way to sort of subtly reboot the image. I will leave that to people to decide as to whether or not that this is what this is for or what it is not for. But that's certainly the story that we have heard.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Gabriel in Richardson. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead.
Getting back to the education part for the governor, I'm wondering what your panelists think about his job in terms of communicating to the the public the importance of us educating our kids for the sake of Texas and for the sake of our well-being, the state, as opposed to the children themselves or the families, and communicating that to corporations, thinking of schools as being the sort of farm teams for the corporations.
Well, it's an interesting point. Everybody talks about the importance of education, and then we take money away from it every single year, it seems like.
I think it's a great question, and I think it's in the interview that Brian did with the governor that's in the magazine, I was actually surprised by that aspect, kind of how strongly he starts talking about public education as the means towards supporting a skilled workforce for Texas. I hadn't really heard him say that often before as kind of part of his mini stump speech. So I think he's kind of starting to do that. And I think that totally makes sense. And I would also note in this context that since he's been governor so long, it's not just that the state's changed, although the state has changed. We've seen the state become a little bit younger, become more diverse, and therefore have different needs for schooling. It's also that the state's economy has changed under his watch, partly to his credit, I think, and that the national economy and the global economy has changed because of globalization, technological change, and so on. So not only do we need more focus on public education in Texas because of what the state has always needed, more investment in public schools, we need more focus on that right now because we're increasingly in a competitive landscape nationally and internationally where you can't have as great chances at securing a good job for yourself if you didn't finish high school or do some kind of vocational training. So I think that he has recently started to kind of talk about that a little more, but he hadn't done that well in the past, and that's perhaps why the party was able to kind of set aside public education as a priority when it had previously been more focused on that.
That's interesting, Gabriel. You may remember that in the last legislative session, the signature bill that came out related to public ed was HB 5, which did a number of things. It changed the pathways to graduation, sort of what the curriculum could do, but it really reduced the number of end of course exams that students had to take to pass, to move from, in some cases, from grade level to grade level, and then certainly end up with a diploma. And one of the big pushbacks that you had on that bill, despite broad support, particularly in the suburban areas, was from the Texas Association of Business and Bill Hammond. And it was that they were concerned that what we were essentially doing was watering down what it meant to get a degree, that it was going to take away from a workforce. And there was a sense that up until the very end, as part of that, Governor Perry was going to veto the bill. We know we heard this specifically from House leaders, and that the concern was this exact thing, that were the public schools doing the job that they should be doing to create an educated workforce going forward.
Texas Monthly journalists Brian D. Sweeney and Erica Greeter are here. The magazine's July issue features a report card of Governor Rick Perry's time in office, as well as an exit interview with him. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalists Erica Greeter and Brian D. Sweeney of Texas Monthly, which in its July issue features 8 issues with letter grades rating the governor's performance over his time in office, as well as an exit interview that he did with Brian Sweeney. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So his worst grade overall from Texas Monthly is in public health, where he gets a D-. Brian, I was fascinated that in his interview with you, he stressed that his sense is that access to health care and health insurance are not the same thing.
That is exactly right. We spent a lot of time talking about this issue. The magazine has written about this issue extensively. We did a cover story on it a couple of years ago. One of the interesting things, you know, Chris, about putting this package together, of course, it's not as if we just parachuted into Austin and thought, hey, I guess we'll figure out what Governor Perry has been up to for the past 14 years. Obviously, we have been writing about him when he was lieutenant governor and going back before that with statewide office and even when he was a member of the House of Representatives. This is an issue that we have followed very, very closely, and I thought that was an interesting way for him to phrase it. We had talked an awful lot, as you know, about Medicaid expansion and his steadfast decision to turn that down. And what I had asked him was, if you were not interested in the federal solution to this problem, what is the Texas solution to this problem? Because however you look at it, if you go back to the year 2003, we ranked number one among the states in the number of uninsured residents. And if you look at the most recent ranking that we have available to us, we still rank number one in the number of uninsured residents. And so what is the issue? And that is exactly what he talked about with me. I don't know that a lot of people are going to buy that argument. I think there absolutely is, as a result, say, of tort reform, that there is more access. There are more doctors. But he really did focus on the notion of access as opposed to insurance, which is a way, I think, for him to try to reframe the debate.
Can I jump in on that?
Sure.
To maybe push
Please.
Back a little bit and cheerfully accept Governor Perry's framework for that. I think he's got a point there, too. And it's a substantive debate that we failed to have as a state, I think, last year with regard to Medicaid expansion, but we really should have had, because I think there are good arguments on that side of the equation. We've seen, we get dinged so often for the lack of access to healthcare insurance in the state, and the worst rate in the country for that, and that's just sort of intractable. And of course, we did not make it better by not expanding Medicaid. But at the same time, if you look at health outcomes, public health results, I mean, disease, days of work missed due to illness, death, we're about average, which is not the aspirational ideal, but we're about average on a lot of these things. There are some, actually, cervical cancer is one, where we're among the worst in the country. But if you think of cancer overall rates, heart disease rates, we're doing okay. And a lot of our big public health issues are things like diabetes, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, not the kind of things that are well addressed by Medicaid as currently structured. So I think that they were not barking up the wrong tree entirely to say that if this program is going to be expanded, we should think about ways to structure it that might make more sense for this particular population in Texas, which is younger than the United States population as a whole and different in other ways, too. But I'm not sure we really had a good...
No, I think that's an excellent point. And I think that, again, we're looking at this over time as mm-hmm. well. I think I used the term earlier, political imagination. Mm-hmm. I will come back to that on this particular issue, because I think that that particular issue was not as that particular answer, I should say, was not quite as satisfying to me, only in the sense that I think that if you look back, say, to what happened in the 2003 session, where once again we had cuts and 150,000 kids were knocked off of the children's health insurance program, in my mind, I just feel that the state is wealthy enough to do better than that, that there is a way that we can solve some of these problems without turning to cutting programs for those people who are the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But I think that's right. And in terms of talking about access versus insurance, it was an interesting way for him to reframe that. And I agree with Erica that even though there was a lot of talk during the 2013 legislative session, which Eric and I were at every single day over there at the Capitol, I don't know that we were able to really advance the ball on that. And there's always a question, to what degree is that politics and what degree is that public policy?
Yeah.
I thought the transportation grade of C was interesting, because one of the things that the magazine article says is that hasn't been great, but some of the problems that we continue to struggle with in transportation have really not been Governor Perry's fault.
Yeah, it's interesting. So maybe this goes to the failure of political imagination that Brian was talking about. This is probably the issue where Governor Perry has tried hardest and been most thwarted. It kind of makes sense, because he's a, you know, you think about him, he's a rural guy. He, I think, even said Dolph Briscoe was a visionary, because Dolph Briscoe expanded roads.
He told me his two favorite governors going back through Texas history were Sam Houston, which is a pretty good one, and Dolph Briscoe, which I think might be somewhat confusing to our readers.
Which is just so weird.
But farm-to-market road system.
So
Dolph
Briscoe,
that's exactly right.
He gave, you know, Dolph Briscoe an unusually high grade because of the farm-to-market roads. But So Perry has been quite preoccupied by the issue for a long time. And you go back through his news clippings, even before he was governor, and he's talking about roads. And it makes sense as a priority for somebody who's very focused on economic development in Texas, as he is, and also has a background from rural Texas. But then he has been thwarted. I mean, he had this kind of big visionary plan for the Trans-Texas Corridor, and it got shouted down from really all sides because it was expensive and had eminent domain implications people didn't like, and involved perhaps a lot of potential for crony politics and so on. So he has not really achieved anything close to the ambitions he once had on the issue. But I think nonetheless, it wasn't really him who was forestalling progress on that front. And then I guess the next question would be, well, as governor, as leader of the party for all his time, shouldn't he have been leading his party to not thwart him on this? And that's probably true, I think. But I guess you govern with the legislature you have.
A C also in transparency and ethics.
It was kind of a similar question, I think, because I don't think he would be considered in a real model of ethical leadership according to any objective standard of ethics. But I'm not sure that most Texas statewide leaders would be, apart from Sam Houston, who I think gets an A grade on that.
A unionist, by the way.
So. And absolutely. And I think in some ways, it's almost like we have a system of government in Texas that encourages some things that are unethical if you think about them from the perspective of other states, right? So we mentioned before the cronyism aspect and the kind of, with regard to the vaccine, the fact that a former staffer of Perry's went on to work for Merck, the company that made the vaccine. And Perry, in his interview with Brian, as Brian mentioned, pushed back really hard on that and says, well, you know, people just really glom onto that fact. But the fact of the matter is, if you have been working in state government for a long time, like everybody you know is going to have been back and forth, public sector, private sector, and so on, which is kind of a weird thing to say because it's so assertive, I guess, on that point. But it kind of is true. We have a system of government in Texas where the governor has a lot of latitude for making appointments. There's this kind of Jacksonian era conceit written in our Constitution that anybody can do the government's job as well as the government itself can do it. So it's totally okay to have this sort of part-time legislature where people have day jobs that might introduce conflicts of interest. So in the kind of Texas context where ethics are sort of an interesting topic,
yeah,
I'm not sure Perry's been the worst on that front.
I'd like to expand that a little bit, Chris, if I can, because mm-hmm. I think the thing that we see that is absolutely transformative about Governor Perry's administration, just through sheer force mm-hmm. of will and the longevity, is that it has really tested the notion of what it means to be a Texas governor. The Constitution, as we know, is a weak constitution all the way around. There's a reason, both practical and philosophical, for why the legislature meets for 140 days every other year. There is a reason why, until the 1974 election cycle, governors were only elected to two-year terms. That's it within our lifetime in this generation that these changes. I don't think that anybody envisioned that you would have a governor who would be in office for 14 years. That's an astounding feat. Even John Connally, who had been elected three consecutive terms and was widely thought of as one of the most powerful governors ever, was only in office for 6 years. And so what you end up doing in a situation like that is that if the power of appointment has always been one of the things that the governor carries with him, he has now made every single appointment in state government top to bottom, sometimes multiple times, and that comes to more than 7,700 people. That is an unbelievable notion. And so in that sense, I think when he says to me, as he did, look, you're not in government as long as I have without knowing people and coming into contact. When you look at that number empirically, it's hard to debate it. On the other hand, it does make you ask that if Republicans have often been the party that has been, you know, asserting term limits and limited government, he has in some ways broken that system, because just by the sheer length of his office and the power that he has created, it is unprecedented in Texas politics. And I think for us, that was the thing that was really fascinating about trying to size up this last period of time. George W. Bush seems like a lifetime ago. It's amazing to see how Texas government has changed. And I don't think that we will see a return to that. I think that whatever happens in the fall elections, again, I happen to believe that Greg Abbott is going to win and will be the next governor of Texas. But I don't believe that Greg Abbott is going to serve for 14 years.
No, I don't think anyone's going to serve for 14 years.
So Governor Perry has talked a lot about how much he likes being governor. I want to ask you both about this, because there are politicians that clearly love being politicians. Maybe they have goals, but they love the thing itself. There are other people for whom elected political office is sort of a means to a policy end. Where would you put Rick Perry on that spectrum?
Huh, that's an interesting question. I don't think we framed it that way. I think he probably does love being governor, because why would you not love, it's like the best job ever. You don't really have to do that much, but you can if you want to.
I'm with Erica. Being the governor of Texas is the greatest job ever.
All of us suckers sitting here, not governor of Texas.
Why am I not the governor of Texas?
It's horrible. You know, and especially at a time when the state has been doing so well on sort of big metrics and kind of coming into the 21st century, outperforming a lot of all the other large states in a lot of ways. I mean, that's an incredibly fun job, I think, to have. As far as did he have a policy agenda, I mean, I guess it's maybe the usual question with limited government type people, that in some sense his policy goal was to continue to advance a small government approach to state policy.
That's right. And you know, I asked him about that, Chris, as to whether or not he believed that had he come to change on any views over the years, or philosophically had he come, you know, had he changed on anything? And remember, when he was a Democratic legislator and was on the Appropriations Committee in the House, which is one of the most powerful committees, if not the most powerful, but certainly one of the most powerful committees, he was part of a very small group of conservative Democrats who back then were really looking at every single thing in the budget and worked very, very hard to scrub the budget. So that notion has always been in his DNA. There's no question about that. And then, of course, he made the switch from being a Democrat to a Republican when he made the race in 1990 against Jim Hightower, and then off he went. I mean, it's an amazing ride and an amazing career, but it is interesting the degree to which he is a career politician. There is no way that one could say that he is not. Yet I do think that there has been a real consistency in the way that he has approached government. You may remember, again, when he ran, you know, for president, the previous time, that a lot of people made a lot about him being, you know, a Democrat or being on Al Gore's committee. I mean, that's baloney in the sense that we have not seen any widespread changes in the way that he looks at it. And keep in mind, you know, Texas for a long time was a Democratic state, but it was a conservative Democratic state.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Phil Graham was a Democrat, too. Absolutely. And actually, also, it was funny looking back at the old clips from Perry, because he has this preoccupation with jobs, too, that just
that's true.
Came out immediately. Right. I mean, he was talking about everything, every agriculture issue when he was commissioner of agriculture, as basically a jobs development program. I mean, it's just a drumbeat.
Our colleague Paul Perka has an essay at the front of the issue kind of framing the historical and cultural contributions of Governor Perry. And, you know, he begins with a lunch that he had with the governor years and years and years ago after he had brought a caterpillar plant, I believe, to Seguin. I think that's right. I hope that's right. Anyway, he had brought these jobs to Texas. And over the lunch, you know, he looked right at Paul and he said, "Do you know how many other governors would have liked to have made that announcement that they brought all these jobs to Texas?" And Paul looked at him for a second, and Perry leans in and he says, "All of them." And I think that's interesting, not only in the competitiveness, but also the fact that economic development and jobs have always been at the forefront of his notion of governance, and that it's what can government do for economic growth. And in many ways, I think what can government do to stay out of the way of economic growth, that will be the hallmark. We didn't hear it in that way framed by Governor Bush, for example.
Right.
Erica Greeter and Brian D. Sweeney write for Texas Monthly Magazine. They both contributed to a report card of Governor Rick Perry's years in office that appears in the July issue of the magazine. That issue also features an exit interview of Governor Rick Perry by Brian D. Sweeney. It's always a pleasure to have both of you with us on the show. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having
us. We appreciate it. Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer of the show. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.